Let's rise above. You're tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. It's the best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Mike Biggs. Today on the program, we feature an encore broadcast of our interview with frontline investigative reporter Arun Gupta, who offers an in-depth look at the extreme right-wing group, the Oath Keepers, in light of their recent convictions. And later, Kevin Pina interviews executive producer Dennis Bernstein about his new book of poems, Notebook 19. All this straight ahead on the best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned. Again, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Up first on the program, we're proud to rebroadcast a recent interview we did with frontline investigative reporter Arun Gupta.
Really delighted to welcome back to these airwaves Arun Gupta. He's a fine investigative reporter, has been covering these extreme right-wing groups for various organizations, wonderful organizations. He's written for The Nation, Raw Story, The Guardian, Jacobin, and a whole bunch of other places. We are happy to have you back. Arun, welcome to Flashpoints.
Thanks for having me on today, Dennis.
Okay, well, it's an important day to have you on because you've been doing crucial research and reporting on these extreme right groups, and everybody knows, and now we're it's sort of like everybody's wondering where the next violence is going to come from. Political violence is now expected by all the U.S. agencies, investigative agencies that are somehow responsible for monitoring violent groups have discovered that it's the extreme right that is putting us all in danger. But let's go to the trial. Let's go to the Oath Keepers. Stuart Rhodes, 18 years. Tell us about, just give us a little bit of the background so people, many people haven't followed this. So tell us about the Oath Keepers. And you've at one point, you wrote that Trump's extremism turned the Oath Keepers from keyboard warriors into seditious coup plotters. Lay this out for us.
Sure. So, Stuart Rhodes, former Army paratrooper, Yale Law School graduate, in 2008, he does a blog post where he warns of President Hillary Clinton. And he says that if she is elected, and of course she was the favorite against Barack Obama, but she didn't win, if she was elected, there was going to be martial law, patriots, their guns were going to be confiscated, they were going to be sent to internment camps, and the government was going to shoot anyone who resisted, including women and children. In the wake of Barack Obama's election, you know, initially there was a shock. on the right, there was this just total exaltation among liberals. I was kind of in that Cassandra part of the left who was warning this is not going to end well, because it was pretty clear, it was very clear that Obama was a neoliberal and that he was opportunistic in terms of his anti-war stance that catapulted him to victory in many ways. So the right, we have this backlash, racist backlash, and that's how we need to understand it. You know, there was a Tea Party movement, and the reporting on it was, oh, this is about small government, and, you know, that's just a load of hooey. It was part of this pattern in American history, going back over 200 years, of every time that there is an upsurge of black protests, power, social movements, there is a violent white backlash. And of course, this goes back to slave rebellion, post-Civil War with the rise of the Klan, Jim Crow, the anti-civil rights movement, Ronald Reagan, and the Tea Party was just the latest manifestation of that. So this blog post goes viral, and what the Oath Keepers were, Stuart Rhodes said, it was based on the law enforcement officers take to defend the Constitution from enemies, foreign and domestic.
Say that again. We lost you. You faded out for a minute, Arun. Say that again. It was made up of who? Say that again, please.
The Oath Keepers was based on this oath that soldiers, military officers take, but also some soldiers and some law enforcement officers, that they are sworn to defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And the idea is that Barack Obama was a domestic enemy to the Constitution, and so it's part of this violent backlash. And it was called the Oath Keepers because Stuart Rhodes' idea was like, hey, we're going to recruit exclusively from active duty or retired military and police officers. And so it was very unusual in terms of right-wing militias. There's only, in terms of like the thousands of these extremist militias that have existed, the only one or two base themselves on former, you know, that recruiting from soldiers and police officers. So on, I believe it's April 17th, 2009, a very significant date. This is the start of the American Revolution in 1776. The first shots fired at Lexington. Stuart Rhodes holds the first muster for the Oath Keepers in Lexington, Massachusetts. And it's also a very important date for the extreme right, because there were a number of extremist incidents. And I think the execution, you can look back through my reporting, that the raw story of a prominent right-wing extremist all happened on the same exact date. So the Oath Keepers kind of come out with this like big bang and hurrah, and they recruit, you know, no one's quite sure how many they recruit. In later years, these lists would be hacked and leaked that showed like tens of thousands of members, that people who had been members of the Oath Keepers at one point or another, and indeed a very significant proportion of them were current or retired soldiers and law enforcement officers. But for a long time, the Oath Keepers were just keyboard warriors. They were, and in today's parlance, they were a boomer MAGA. You know, it's basically these angry old white guys just ranting on the internet. And they were derided by a lot of the more active militias that were out there. They got themselves involved in a number of minor incidents. There was one in Quartzsite, Arizona. And I'll note it's interesting because if anyone read the book Nomadland or saw the movie Nomadland, that this is one of the towns in Nomad Land where you find kind of these down and out people who had gathered there. But where they really came to prominence was with the Clive and Bundy confrontation with the government. And that was, I'm trying to remember, was that 20? I think it was 2015. Right. That
remind people what happened there and make that connection for us.
So Cliven Bundy is a longtime criminal. He has stolen well over $1 million of taxpayer money. He's been illegally grazing his cattle on public land and has refused to pay the fees. And it's important to note that the fees the government charges to ranchers is about 10% of what private ranchers charge to private landowners charge to other ranchers to be able to graze their cattle. So he has this whole notion that, you know, he's a Mormon, and Mormonism, frankly, it's a Disneyland religion. A lot of Christian fundamentalists despise Mormonism because it's in Mormonism, you get to ascend to be the god of your own universe. And so they have a lot of strange ideas, including that they are the original settlers and owners of the land. And so that's what he was claiming, that he had this ancient right to all this land, and so he wasn't going to pay these fees. And this went on for a couple of decades, and finally the government is like, okay, we're going to they warned him, there was numerous he lost numerous court cases, there were injunctions, and they finally said, we're going to seize your cattle. So he called for a range war against the federal government. And by this point, you know, after Obama was elected, there was this just massive proliferation of right-wing militias. If you look, and again, like you could, my reporting on the Raw Story and also Daily Beast, Jacobin, other places, I recount how there were all these extremist right-wing racist murders right after Obama was elected in early 2009. And so these militias converge on Cliven Bundy's ranch in Nevada, and heavily armed, and the government is completely caught flat-footed. And so they try to negotiate with him. Eventually, when they seize his cattle, the BLM employees, and, you know, as opposed to like jackbooted thugs, most of them are just regular employees, right? They're not even law enforcement officers. They're surrounded in this very dramatic showdown with cameras rolling by snipers, and to ensure that the situation doesn't escalate into a bloodbath, the government retreats, and they hand the extreme right this huge victory, you know, completely emboldening them. And Stuart Rhodes was one of the militia leaders who responded and came with a bunch of his militia members. And I, for one, it came out later that his militia and another militia nearly got into a firefight, that they apparently drew guns on each other and were screaming at each other that they were going to kill the other. And then Rhodes ended up bugging out, right? A bunch of the militia stayed behind to, like, quote-unquote, protect Bundy. And Rhodes claimed that the then Attorney General, Eric Holder, he had information that he was going to do a drone strike on Cliven Bundy's ranch, and he called for everyone to bug out, and he freaked out and took all his militia with him, and they were, like, ridiculed and made fun of by the other militia members. And so it wasn't a particularly auspicious launch into real space or into real time, you know, in terms of what those keepers were doing. But most people missed this, and the Oath Keepers got a huge surge of interest and right. New members after the showdown with between Bundy and the Bureau of Land Management.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are really glad to be joined by Arun Gupta. He has written extensively about the extreme right. You may have heard that there were some convictions having to do with the Oath Keepers, particularly the leader, Stuart Rhodes. He got some 18 years. Before we get into some of the practical parts of that, what exactly was he convicted for?
He was convicted on a number of counts. The big one was seditious conspiracy, which is a Civil War era law that's been rarely used before. Like, you know, as with these things, it often gets used against the left. I think the last time anyone was convicted, it was a Puerto Rican nationalist, if I recall correctly, like 50 years ago. There was also this militia called this white nationalist militia called the Hutari militia, which about 10 years ago, 15 years ago, the government tried to indict them on seditious conspiracy, or they did indict them, but they failed to convict them. And so it's something that's considered very high stakes, like you are being tried with attempting to overthrow the federal government. And also the case, at least initially, was considered dicey because, you know, like with the Proud Boys, who were also convicted, there was this whole thing about, well, there wasn't exactly a plan, that you can't prove that they were acting violently. And, you know, the government did have a friendly jury, it being Washington, D.C. But I think the other thing to remember is that I think, you know, this also potentially sets a dangerous precedent, and I've been concerned all along that the next time we see a Republican president, which is going to happen in 4 or 8 years, or, you know, 2024, 2028, that they will use it against the left, particularly just for nonviolent, traditional nonviolent direct action. You know, we see this kind of like extreme governmental repression going on in against the left, both in Florida, against anti-abortion activists, against peaceful activists protesting Cop City in Georgia, where they're bringing them up on terrorism charge for complete traditional nonviolent civil disobedience. So, you know, I think there is, we could say for those concerned about right-wing extremism, there is a positive element in terms of Rhodes being convicted. There's also other problems with this.
Go on.
So I'll just quickly mention that I can talk about more. A couple other problems. So one, the prosecutors asked for 25 years. And I know of no instance where, and the judge gave 18 years. I cannot find any instance of, you know, again, like you want to talk like whether it's mafia or drug traffickers or political left-wing political activists, where the government keeps the prosecutors keep saying, hey, we want like 10-20 years, and the federal judges in almost every single instance give less than what the prosecutors are asking for. That is almost completely unheard of, especially in dozens and dozens of cases now. And a lot of these insurrectionists have gotten slaps on the wrist. Now, I think this will make, the second point is, I think this will make a lot of the extremists out there a little more wary of openly trying to overthrow, talking about violent overthrow of the government. But it should have never gotten to the point that it did. Stuart Rhodes, I had these extensive conversations, interviews with his wife, Tasha Adams, last fall, and I wrote a big profile for the Daily Beast, and where she, and I've talked to other experts who said, like, you know, she's a very credible source. You know, obviously she lived with him for a long time, but everything she says has as far as people are able to find, has checked out. She describes Stuart Rhodes as extremely violent, paranoid, that he was engaged in all sorts of financial shenanigans, a drug addict, a sex addict. You know, and it's just like, how did he get to such a position of power? And you could say this about a lot of the right-wing extremists. How did they get to such positions of power? People like Enrique Tarrio, where he's hobnobbing with, you know, U.S. senators like Ted Cruz, like Roger Stone, Alexander, you know, Andy Now, Joey Gibbs, all these guys. They are just basically these grifters, and a lot of them are petty criminals, and they were embraced by the Republican Party. And the third point, which I think is really important to remember, is like, okay, we still have a lot of these extremist groups out there, neo-Nazi, you know, violent white nationalists, but the Republican Party itself is now completely embracing this extremism.
Yes.
They have embraced vigilante justice in a way that you have to, again, go to the pre-civil rights era to see, you know, the embrace of, like, Daniel Perry, the ex-U.S. Marine who murdered Jordan Neely on the subway. Jordan Neely was having a mental health crisis. The NYPD, and, you know, hardly the most neutral institution when it comes to racial matters, said Jordan Neely did not violently threaten anyone. He did not threaten Daniel Penny, yet Daniel Penny chose to come up from behind him and murder him. He is now a hero to the right. You know, Donald Trump embraced Kyle Rittenhouse, whose mommy drove him to Wisconsin, where he murdered two Black Lives Matter activists. In Texas, you have Greg Abbott saying he's going to pardon this guy, Daniel Penny, not Perry, but Penny, who went to a Black Lives Matter event and murdered someone after he said on social media he was going to kill someone. And he was convicted and sentenced to 20 years, and Abbott says he will pardon him. So you have this embrace of extrajudicial assassinations by the Republican Party. And I think this is kind of what's most dangerous now.
Let me ask you, it's sort of a double question. Are we seeing the emergence of a completely new right wing? You talked about the Bundy connection. But are we seeing a whole new expanded wave of organized right-wing activity? I mean, in this context, do we know yet? Are there any connections between the Oath Keepers, the Proud Boys, and directly and the attempt to overthrow the election? What do we know about direct interaction? Anything close to that we know about?
Between the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys? I mean, there was a famous...
No. I want to hear about that, too. But what about any kind of connection between the Trump, between his activists who are reaching out? You know, Trump is already saying he's ready to pardon these folks.
Roger Stone would know, Alexander would know, you know, I think these are the key people. You know, Roger Stone, I mean, he is an astonishing, you know, individual in terms of his ability to engage in dirty tricks and escape any accountability whatsoever. I would not at all doubt that there was a lot of you know, talk and discussion and strategizing. You know, we early on had all these rumors after the January 6th insurrection about, you know, what was Matt Gaetz up to? What was Marjorie Taylor Greene up to? You know, these reports that they were feeding insurrectionist information about tunnels and where meetings were at. So, you know, these are all threads that have not been followed up on. There's just a lot we don't know. I think there's a lot of, like, flaws with the investigation. And, you know, this points to, I think, a structural historical problem that the liberal media are completely incapable of understanding and analyzing, that they always want to play both sides because of their BS objectivity, which is just fairy dust. You know, you have one side, the right wing, that is completely committed to ruthless power, just utter law breaking. They're completely criminal. And you have the liberals who want to uphold institutions that have been completely gutted and undermined by decades of right-wing covert warfare, like the Supreme Court. Remember, you know, Biden was going to address the Supreme Court. Whatever happened to that? You know, the fact that the right has stacked the court with all these extremists who just, like, completely make laws up as they see fit, like, you know, overturn established doctrine whenever it suits them for their political agenda. So there's a severe imbalance here that these prosecutions and the stance of the government is not addressing. I mean, I think, you know, without going off too much on a tangent here, I'm starting to call, you know, the Biden administration, it's like a cadaver capitalism, you know, zombie empire, you know, that it's basically brain dead, but all it knows is it just keeps going on this mindless path of destruction, whether it's like, you know, just catastrophic climate change, this massive remilitarization project that it's using the Ukraine war for, these huge giveaways to the rich. This is, you know, they're completely bungling the debt crisis with the Republicans. I mean, we're in a pretty pathetic state. We're relying on these bozos to save us from.
And I know, I always love the fact that you don't hold back. I want to tell people we're speaking with Arun Gupta, but I really want to focus you back to what's going on in Washington, and I want you to talk about, we're hearing more and more about the kind of participation in the insurrection we've seen from within the forces of the, everybody, you know, I don't know how many, is there one black FBI agent in the whole country? I don't know, there's probably a few more than that, but everybody knows that they've got a history of racism. We're hearing more and more reports about participation by cops and FBI agents. I don't know if you remember, back in the day, I investigated what was called the Old Boys Network, where you had all these federal officers throughout the South who used to participate in these old boy parties. Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, can you count the jelly beans and be able to vote? So I'm very suspicious about the nature of racism and who gets investigated and who doesn't. What do we know about that?
Unfortunately, not very much, because the Democrats made a deal with the devil. Liz Cheney, in this case, the final January 6th, she issued just this completely unhinged press release. Like, she prevented an investigation of the law enforcement response. She tried this, she succeeded in squelching much of the, you know, January 6th committee's findings into the connection of far-right extremists. And in this press release, she said, like, you know, that these are patriotic Americans. And, you know, remember when Dick Cheney, the butcher of Iraq, the Iraq war, nobody knows how many Iraqis it's killed. 1 million, 2 million. I've seen estimates of 3 million. The butcher of Iraq was cheered. The architect of the 9/11 wars was cheered by the Democrats when he came into Congress last year. So they made a deal with the devil, with his daughter, with Liz Cheney, that she was able to squelch a lot of this investigation. Because the thing we know is, never call the law enforcement response into Jan 6 an intelligence failure. Every single red warning light was flashing red across the country. There's this infamous Department of Homeland Security call that they had a few days. And interesting you say, like, a black law enforcement officer. I believe this was the call where the DHS official was a black law enforcement officer. And, you know, they, as part of the post 9/11 apparatus, they set up these fusion centers where the idea is there are dozens of them. I'm not even sure how many they are. I know every state has one, but there are others. So dozens and dozens. The idea is you bring together all these different law enforcement agencies where they share information, because the reality, and you know, you can read the stuff from left-wing scholars like Christian Williams and Alex Vitale and Stuart Schrader, who investigate, who write a lot about policing. They'll tell you that law enforcement agencies are very jealous of their turf and territory. And so these fusion centers were supposed to address that. And so during this call, the DHS official says they expected a few fusion centers to get on. They said every single fusion center got on, and all of them were saying, we are seeing all this evidence, basically, of a coming violent insurrection on Jan. 6. The Pentagon knew it. The D.C. police knew it. The Capitol Hill police knew it. The FBI knew it. Everybody knew it. And they still let them do it. And I think the real thing that should put a chill down everyone's spine is if those guys had guns, and that's what Stuart Rhodes said after January 6th, my only regret is that we didn't have weapons, right? If they had gone in guns blazing, well, be, and I'm not exaggerating, be living under a Trump fascist dictatorship right now. Because when you had so many of these violent insurrectionists, you know, it was probably about 10,000, and you just have, like, you know, maybe 1,000, 1,500 basically lightly armed police, they would have overwhelmed them. They could have, it could have been another Reichstag, you know, where they completely butchered the Congress, and then Trump would have just declared himself dictator. You know, who was going to stop him at that point? And that was the government response, you know, to it. Meanwhile, you have like a couple of dozen activists in Georgia who are facing like life in prison for nonviolently protesting this like $800 million training center for police brutality, right? This is the divide in terms of the response. But you should we talk about the military and police angle for a second, which I think is important?
Yeah,
as well?
Yeah. We have just a minute or two left, but I'd love you to do that, Erwin, please.
So, you know, it's like this is, we have to realize, and this is a complicated question, but the Ukraine war, the Ukrainians have a completely legitimate fight, but the U.S. is using it as a new 9/11. They are engaged on a project of global militarization and warfare. And what we saw with the 9/11 wars is you create all these veterans who are angry, who have PTSD, not all of them, but a lot of them become violent extremists. This happened with the Vietnam War and Posse Comitatus, right. And this happens with every epoch of warfare. And so we know dozens and dozens of the January 6th insurrectionists were retired or current military or police officers, a huge right. number of them. And essentially the government is basically training and organizing the terrorists who are trying to overthrow it. And it's global, you know, it's this U.S. imperial project that keeps doing it. And so I find it appalling that you see quite a few leftists who have signed on for the U.S. This just insane support for Ukraine that is turning it into this existential struggle against Russia. That's not to justify Russia's brutality or invasion, but nobody should be supporting the U.S. In this project, because it's going to have both global blowback and domestic blowback, as we saw with the January 6th insurrection and the 9/11 wars.
It is amazing. This is a subject, we could just open this one up in terms of what happens when we send young people off to wars that they don't understand and we don't understand, and they're and there's the confusion of the media, in which the media, all the liberal media, really have become spokespeople. It's almost embarrassing for the current administration. And I'm sure if a whole bunch of Republicans get in, everybody on the liberal channels will be Republican, if they're not Republican already. But it is information.
Can I make one quick point about that? Yes, please. Go. So, okay, those drone attacks on the Kremlin. Numerous liberal media, big liberal media outfits, just look it up, said that it could have been a Russian false flag. A day or two ago, U.S. government says Ukraine was probably behind it. That is astonishing. The liberal media, exactly, are just, they're doing it what they did during Vietnam, except now for the Ukrainian government. They are just acting as stenographers for Ukrainian government propaganda. Again, they have a legitimate struggle against Russian imperialism and brutality, but this is not the role of the media to act as their propaganda.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Up next on the program, we're proud to present a rebroadcast of our interview that Flashpoint senior producer Kevin Pina did with Flashpoint executive producer Dennis Bernstein about his latest book of poems, Notebook 19.
Hi, this is Kevin Pina, senior producer for Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, today I get to do something really special, which is I get to interview the executive producer of Flashpoints, Dennis Bernstein, who just released a new book of poems, which we're going to be discussing a little bit later. But I just want to tell you a little bit about Dennis. Dennis, my God, I'm going to tell you what I know about Dennis, which is since WBAI in New York, good Lord, it's got to span 40 years ago, at least.
Yeah.
Reporting in WBAI, beginning his esteemed career as an investigative journalist. Of course, those who know this program, you know the kind of work that he does, getting those hard stories, getting to the truth, and at the same time, of course, is one of the, you know, one of the just bulwark fundraisers for KPFA, and certainly a staunch Pacifica reporter. Dennis, my pleasure. Welcome to my segment on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
Well, it is nice to be here with you, Kevin. You are a terrific journalist, and always honored to work with you.
New book, Notebook 19. I've been reading it. I see that you got an esteemed poet who wrote the introduction, Jack Foley. I loved the opening remark, and of course he ended his opening with one of your poems, Death from a Distance, which we'll get into a little bit later. Let me just read a little bit from Jack Foley, what he has to say about this. I like his introduction, the foreword here. There is a specter haunting these poems, but it is not the specter Marx and Engels saw haunting Europe in the famous first sentence of the Manifesto of the Communist Party. That document goes on, all the powers of old Europe have entered into a holy alliance to exorcise the specter. The specter of this book is COVID-19, and it is not the powers of old Europe that are seeking to exercise it, but the powers of the whole world. I thought that was a very beautiful statement.
Yeah, by Foley. I really appreciate that from Jack, a wonderful poet and an advocate for poetry. We love him.
And advocates for social justice as well.
Yes.
Been around a long time.
Yeah.
So tell me, Dennis, this is on the heels of your first book, which was Five Oceans and a Teaspoon, which won the 2020 IPPI Gold Medal Award for Poetry and the 2020 Best Book Award for Poetry by the American Book List, the finalist as well for the 2020 Best Book Award. What inspired this new book? So obviously it's COVID themed, but I've read through this. It's not all about COVID. It's a lot of interweaving of your experiences over your life with, of course, this unique experience that we went through since March 2020.
Well, you know, Kevin, I write in the afterword to the book, Notebook 19, that the extraordinary thing for me in dealing with COVID is that it sort of started in 1918, because 1918, my dad, was being given his life, his first breath, by my paternal grandmother. And 1918, essentially, her last breath became his first breath, because about a half hour after she gave birth to him, she died of that 1918 pandemic, the flu epidemic. And this was a major thing through my father's whole life. He lamented the loss, the impact of the COVID. And I used to say to myself, wow, I am really glad I never had to deal with anything like that. And then here comes,
boom,
COVID, bam. And all of a sudden I'm living my father's life all over again. So this is really what began to trigger the poem. And I actually had, when I first started writing this, I write this in the afterword, I had a dream in which my father was standing guard outside my bedroom, you know, sort of on guard for some kind of invisible enemy that could hurt his children. So hence Notebook 19, and all the things that go around. And then there was the dramatic suffering that followed that 1918 pandemic. We saw the same parallel structures and the same kinds of insanity. So it was pretty amazing.
Well, that's a real interesting touchstone to open with. But let me tell our listeners, this is Kevin Pina, senior producer of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. I have the honor of interviewing our own executive producer, Dennis Bernstein, who has just released a new book of poetry called Notebook 19. Dennis, you know, for me, sometimes they're the same brain, but often I have to say it's two parts of my brain, which is to be the creative sort and then to be the sort of investigative journalist sort. And lucky am I when the twain meets. I'm just wondering, how do you deal with that? Are they the same parts of your brain? Or are they two distinct parts? How does that work out for you?
Well, I can answer that lots of different ways. I could say that I get some of my breaking stories back from the Rumi and Kabir in the 15th century, news of the universe. So I see, we report the daily news, Kevin, you and I, we do this together, the news of the day. And then poetry is sort of the news of the eternity, the news of the universe. But I do see it as information on lots of different levels. And sometimes journalism can't work. People have been stuck or whatever. You can't get to them with journalism, but you can get to them with a poem. I'm thinking about, you know, I was thinking about a lot lately about Anita Hill and my poetry teacher, Muriel Rukeyser, who has a line that goes, "What would happen if one woman told the truth about her life? The world would split open." And then you think of all the women truth tellers of our time and all this kind of stuff. So the poem is information in a deeper way. Muriel says in a poem, in her poem Islands, the first line is, "Oh, for God's sake, they are connected underneath." You know, like humans, like we all are connected. So the imagery, poetry, sort of sometimes it skips the brain and goes right to the heart with the info that you need to survive.
Right, and then sometimes we have that sort of experience of the collective unconscious where you get that sense where if one of us is talking about it, others of us are talking about it, right? And thematically. And
yes.
And I think you capture that as well in much of your writing and your poetry.
Thank you.
I want to... just for a second, talk about Robert Knight. You have a really beautiful poem. And of course, I knew Robert as well. Robert and you and I worked in tandem for about a year, 2 years there with Haiti.
Yes.
Where Robert would do those amazing opening reports, right? The night report.
And with rhetoric that on the highest level.
Exactly.
He could write, yeah.
And you and I would follow it up with the hard report on the ground, and it worked very well together. But, you know, he was a very special soul. Let's talk a little bit about Robert, a little bit about how he inspired that poem.
Sure. Well, Robert and I played a major role in breaking the Iran-Contra scandal from our sister station WBAI in New York. We also wrote some key pieces, like, for instance, Spin magazine, that broke major, helped to put Pacifica on the map and broke major stories around the way in which Oliver North had worked with the Contras and drug traffickers to illegally arm the Contras to overthrow the Nicaraguan government. There are so many stories about that. But Robert and I were deeply engaged. And then Robert leaves when he heads to Panama, when all the entire U.S. Army is looking for Noriega, and Robert finds him in hiding because we had this special relationship with the government. We had been interviewing different members of the government before the U.S. invasion of Panama. And so Robert finds him and interviews him in hiding. Interviews Noriega in hiding and comes back to the United States. I'm telling you, Kevin, when he got back to little tiny WBAI, every reporter in New York was in the studio wanting to know where Noriega was, how did he talk to him, and could they have the sound? Robert Knight, present day.
Extraordinary. And now this is Dennis reading a few selections from his book, Notebook 19.
Before the sun wakes dawn and the town street sweeper does the rounds, fear stalks me. The mitten-knuckled kiss of the virus, a key below the sea of silence, threatens to repossess my name. Radio Robert goes silent. Our last time together, we shared rice cakes and nut butter. Hot sake sent a warm wave up the spine, and we bathed in starlight where the Russian river returns the sky's gifts to the sea. Now what's left of you, my friend? 30 years of taped voices. You're perfectly invisible as usual. Hard to believe that yesterday is really forever, that death owns tomorrow. My mother's will. We made out her will at 6 feet. It's going to be simple, Mom assures me. I'm giving you everything except the virus. I'm saving that for your father in hell. Hospice notes. 1. Parallel structure. Tonight, my mother's nightmares are being cared for by the hospice nurse. I'm listening out back to a couple of anxious crows yapping it up over the corpse of a fallen pigeon. 2. Untouchable. My mother is dying. I am given gloves to wear each time before we hug. Every time I put them on, she dies a little more. Love and death in the age of 19. Our friend is dying. It is time for the purest transmissions of love. From a distance, the smallest moves must make all the difference. Fractured dreams. The moon fell out of my pocket and rolled across the floor of the crosstown bus. The glowing circle cracked into little pieces of indirect light.
Just beautiful, Dennis. And let me remind our listeners, that was the voice of Dennis J. Bernstein, the executive producer of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, reading from his new book of poetry called Notebook 19. Just amazing, Dennis. A real confluence of hope and sadness, of pain, and yet there is a lightness behind it. That I can perceive as palpable.
That's beautiful. I appreciate hearing that, Kevin. It the idea poetry, you know, is sort of the idea is to help transcend, to make put all the things that are going on in a bit of a different context, and with a context that maybe helps you understand better. Deal with it better, communicate better about, you know, what you're feeling. So this was my offering to many of my friends and people who were working in the field, and, you know, just the people who I was interviewing. You know, it was sort of another way of dealing with all the suffering that was going on. And you know, I think poetry became more important to people during the pandemic. It does, you know, just like Pacifica Radio does. You know, when you want something more real, when you need something, when there's so much going on that just the regular same old isn't going to do, you turn to Pacifica Radio, you turn to KPFA, you turn to poetry. You want to go deeper. You're tired of the surface life. And, you know, so it's a real gift to be able to do the journalism and to also do the poetry. And my life goes something like this, Kevin. I wake up every morning, just about every morning at about 5 o'clock, and I write poetry. I have 100,000,000 poems. I drive all my friends crazy about the next book. But I write and write and read the most beautiful things I can find until I start writing. And I do that for a couple of hours until I get that first phone call or that first email from somebody who is sharing something very important that makes me cry, you know, and brings me back to reality. And it's time. So we go from the poetry to the journalism.
You can sense the experience that you have, that you carry with you.
I love poetry because my mother loved poetry. My mother wrote me a poem every birthday from like age 1 to age 40. At age 40, she said, "The next year, you write me the poem. It's your poem, your poetry has begun." But here's my mom, here's the story that I had to grow up with. My mom wrote a poem to Hank Ketcham. He was the author of the Dennis the Menace comic strip. And my mother's poem was about how his menace couldn't come close to her menace. And she made the case poetically. So it opens, and it was published in the New York Post at the time, right next to the column, Hank Ketcham, and it opens up, "Were you to search from here to Venice, you couldn't find just such a menace as my son from birth called Dennis. Compared to mine, yours is a mere apprentice." And then she went through all the terrible things I had done, you know, trying to flush the kitten down the toilet bowl and all kinds of stuff.
And I'm in conversation with Dennis J. Bernstein, the executive producer of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, Dennis, but before I let you go, I want to know if you'd be willing to share a poem from your other two books. Your first book was Special Ed: Voices from a Hidden Classroom. Is there something from that you'd like to share?
Sure. Well, I taught special ed for close to 10 years in some of the toughest neighborhoods, they say, in New York City. And I had beautiful children, and it was an amazing experience, and it changed my life. And so my first major book of poems is called Special Ed, Voices from a Hidden Classroom. And, you know, it's sort of like I tried to keep them awake 40 years ago, and they're still keeping me awake nights. They're still in my dreams, falling off their chairs, telling me to tell their story. So I did in this book. This one is called Paulie's Bouncing Bible. He carried his basketball wherever he went. Sometimes he bounced it fiercely and took aim at hoops that only he could see. Sometimes he twirled it on one finger like a bulbous ballerina. But mostly Paulie held the ball between his palms, against his chest, the way a preacher holds a Bible to make God's point. Just like his mother's little Christ, it strengthened his grip on things, extended his palms around a world he was barely able to hold on to. Wow. So that was Paulie's Bouncing Bible.
Lots of imagery in that. I love that poem.
Oh, yeah. I love my kids. They love me. And we had a ball together. We all hated school.
Got through it, though. So listen, I want to... So Five Oceans of the Teaspoon, which was the book that came before Notebook 19.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about the title. What is that title about?
One time long ago, I was actually at Hanford reporting with a biologist who was documenting how the Hanford nuclear plant was turning the local greens and flowers nuclear, and he had a Geiger counter there, and he said, he turns at one point, he says to me, he says, you know, you should think of it this way. He says, you know, here in this world right now, we're all sharing, think of it as maybe a teaspoonful of water, and we're about to run out. So that's somehow I wrote a poem and a couple of poems, and I love that line and the thought of, you know, sharing a teaspoon of water with the rest of the world, obviously was poetry. And this guy was great. He literally sent a jar of radioactive jam to the governor of Washington State and saying, hey, you got to close this place down. It's still a nightmare.
Do you have a poem you'd like to share from that book?
Sure.
Thank you.
This is a very important poem to me. I wrote it when my father was dying. I was in the room with him when essentially I sketched this out, and it was sort of like my last couple of hours, last day with him. It's called Strong Medicine. The night before he died, he craved for ice cream on a stick. He swore he heard the bells outside the truck across the street. Could I sneak out and buy a round for all of us? His treat. There was no truck across the street, no crisp bells crackling, but the canteen in the basement did have two dusty old machines dispensing pops and cones and cups. I filled the slots with coins. At 50 cents a shot, those two machines unleashed more vital pain relief that night than the steady drip of morphine clouding father's final scene. Ah, the loot, he beamed and drew a shallow breath, and then another. I toast to the bitter and the sweet. He tore the wrapper off his treat before he lost his breath completely. I watched him eat. I watched him eat like a kid on the sneak before dinner that night as death took a brief backseat to a chocolate-covered ice cream bar on a stick.
Wow. Wow. That's amazing. That's a beautiful
Thank you, poem. Kevin. Thank wow. you, and thank you for letting me read that poem. It's really, you know, poetry is also a way, I think of it as my grief reconstruction kit. And it's a way of going back and at least healing the imaginary past. You know, and dreams and poetry and, you know, are you know, you could, my father is still calling me the day before my mother's birthday to remind me her birthday is coming up. And he's been dead 10 years. You know what I'm saying? This is poetry.
They never leave us. And you have a beautiful way of capturing that sense of what it
is. Thank you.
Well, again, that's been Dennis Bernstein. He has a new book, Notebook 19. It really is a series of reflections on COVID, but it's much more than that. And I encourage all of our listeners to please go get a copy, if for no other reason than to support the work that Dennis has done. But more of a reason is because of the beauty that I believe he's captured and the spirit of who he is that we see reflected in across these three books, but especially in Notebook 19. Dennis, it's always an honor and a pleasure that you call on me to do these sort of special segments with you. I really, really love you and really appreciate you, bro.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Our goal is to create an atmosphere devoid of